Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for May 3, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And first up, in about 5 minutes or so, we'll be talking with Joel Shalit, who is a former managing editor of Tikkun magazine, author of several books, including Jerusalem Calling, a memoir of growing up in Israel and the United States. We'll talk to him about, first of all, what's going on with Israeli politics? Government looking shaky, but nothing very clear in the way of succession there. And also, are the Zionists beginning to lose their grip in the United States? We'll talk with Joel about that. It does seem like they are getting just a little hysterical maybe things are not quite going their way. But maybe I'm just being a little too wishful in my thinking. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear two interviews on the topic of carbon offsets. I apologize for being so obsessed with climate change. This won't last forever. But first, we'll hear from Fiona Harvey, who is the environment editor of the Financial Times. We'll be talking in a rather balanced way about whether you can actually pay your way out of pollution. And then a little later, we'll hear from Kevin Smith, who is an author of a report from Carbon Trade Watch, who is highly critical of the whole idea, and we'll get a little radical balance out of him. Before we get to all that, just a few words about the economic news. The U.S. economy has been growing rather slowly over the last year or so, around 2% growth rate, which is a third or more below its long-term average of 3 to 3.5%. And, of course, I am bracketing all the questions about the environmental sustainability of growth, which is, of course, these are, of course, profound and crucial questions. But, well, when you're talking about GDP growth in the next quarter or two, it just seems kind of hard to incorporate the big picture into the little. For most of us, our well-being in the short term will depend on whether our economy is growing or not, which means whether we will have jobs and wages or not. So anyway, if we are growing at a rate below the potential growth rate, then in theory, the unemployment rate should rise. And rule of thumb is that for every point in growth below that potential growth rate, the unemployment rate should creep up by about 0.4 of a point. So since we're growing by about a point below the long-term average, or maybe slightly more than that, we should see the unemployment rate rising by about a half a point in the coming months. It hasn't yet, and there does seem to be something of a delayed reaction. The unemployment rate now running 4.4, 4.5%. If these normal relationships hold in the near future, and if the U.S. economy doesn't accelerate in the coming months, then we should see the unemployment rate rising towards 5%, which is probably what the Federal Reserve wants. It's very likely that they would like slack in the labor market, as they say, to reduce inflationary pressures. They haven't gotten much of that yet, but that seems to be what they are gunning for. They haven't gotten it yet, but they may start getting it perhaps as early as tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning we get the employment report, what happened in the job market in the month of April. It's really the first significant economic release that covers the month of April. Very important one in every sense, important economically, important to most people whose livelihoods depend upon the state of the job market. I'm expecting it to show only modest job growth, quite likely we'll see an uptick in the unemployment rate. That is only to be expected with the Federal Reserve having pushed up interest rates and showing no signs of reversing. And now with oil prices returning to their recent highs and gas prices hitting about $3 a gallon, this is, of course, puts quite a pinch on consumer spending, consumer incomes. So that plus the ongoing deflation of the housing bubble, all this should be a serious drag in the economy. The standard view on Wall Street and similar environs is that this is a brief interruption of growth and that happy days will be here again in a few months. I'm skeptical, but we shall see. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Joel Shalit. Yeah. And that bit from the Israeli punk band Dir Yassin, and the song has false consciousness in the title, but I can't remember exactly what it is, and I forgot the cue sheet that tells me what music I'm playing, so I'm going to have to do that from memory. Apologies for that, and for the flubbed identifications to come. But we are now joined on the line by Joel Shalit, who is the former managing editor of Tikkun magazine, author of the memoir Jerusalem Calling, and all-around expert on the politics of American Judaism as well as Israeli politics and culture. Welcome to WBAI, Joel.
Hey, nice to be with you.
So, Dir Yassin, play a little bit from them. Tell us their story.
Excuse me?
I just played a little bit from Dir Yassin, the band. So tell us a little bit of their story.
Dir Yassin were the foremost anarcho-punk band, and really Israeli punk band, period, of like the last 15 years. It's really, you can't talk about Israeli punk without talking about Dir Yassin. They're broken up now. They've metamorphosed recently into a band called Smartut Kahol Lavan. But Dir Yassin's work really stands head and shoulders above anything that its former members are presently doing. They had just had a brand new anthology of their work come out on a German label called Alerta Antifascista, ironically enough. And it's available in the United States through Profane Existence Distribution mail order. And I'd order it if you liked what you heard. It's a great record.
And, of course, they're named after a site of a famous massacre, right? So a very provocative name they chose.
Dir Yassin were named after a village, an Arab village near Jerusalem, which in either 1947 or 48 was ethnically cleansed. I believe about 250 villagers were killed by former Prime Minister Menachem Begin's right-wing guerrilla organization, the Irgun. And you could not, if you're going to be an Israeli hardcore band, Dir Yassin is about as good a name as you can choose.
It certainly is. And I should explain to the audience that you're joining us from an airport waiting room, so apologies for the background noise, but that's the only way we can get you here. All right, let's talk first about Israeli politics before turning to the state of American Zionism. There was a report that came out the other day that slammed Prime Minister Olmert's conduct of last summer's war on Lebanon.
The Vinograd report. Yeah.
Apparently, variations in the word "fail" appear 175 times in the course of this report. Yeah. His approval rating is around 3%, which is about a tenth as high as George Bush's dismal ratings. He refuses to resign. Meanwhile, the scary Benjamin Netanyahu is leading in the polls, but he's only got about 26%. The runners-up are 9-6-5-4. So it looks like we've got a very confused and divided political scene. What's your reading of what's going on in Israel now?
Well, you know, Israelis don't have really any leadership alternatives to turn to that they believe could mount a credible challenge to the status quo, being represented both by Prime Minister Olmert and by the Likud party leader Benjamin Netanyahu. They're both two sides of the same coin, and one must remember that they both were senior members of the same party, exact same generation of leadership, too, until a little over a year ago. You know, so Netanyahu has not been implicated in the current meltdown taking place in the Israeli political system because he's in the opposition. He's not a member of the Kadima party, and Likud are not sitting in coalition with Kadima and Labor, and therefore can somehow distance themselves from the debacle that took place in Lebanon last summer in which the Israeli army could not declare itself a winner.
Well, I think even the Bush administration is even conceding they're calling it a strategic defeat for Israel, which is a pretty strong language coming from them. So is it perceived as a loss among Israelis?
Yeah, for the most part. You know, I think the Israelis... it's interesting. I mean, in Israel, I think that there's still some degree of reluctance to call it an outright defeat because the Israeli army was resoundingly defeated by its own by years of its own self-mismanagement, you know. And so I think Israelis look at that and say, well, the army was completely crippled by itself, by bad leadership, by bad political planning, and so it's difficult to say that Hezbollah resoundingly defeated the Israeli army when we, in fact, potentially defeated ourselves.
Well,
that's how it's discussed, you know?
That sounds like more than a bit of denial, say. I mean, is there any sense that...
That's correct.
It seems like talking about... military strategic aspects of the defeat. The chief of staff has been blamed for poor understanding of the military strategy. But is there any sense in the public, Israeli public, that this regime of permanent occupation and war is not sustainable?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Polls indicate a fairly substantial majority of Israelis continue to believe over the last several years, that the occupation cannot continue, that it ultimately will destroy Israel, and that the Israeli project will only succeed within the context of a final peace settlement with the Palestinians that specifies a two-state solution with contiguous borders for the Palestinians. The problem is that the Israeli political leadership, to a large degree, both within the mainstream political parties and within the military, continues to find itself committed to maintaining the occupation in one form or another. And so there's a dramatic disconnect between mainstream Israeli voters and the Israeli system, political system at large, the political establishment, which includes many members of the military leadership. There are some, believe it or not, for left-wing ears, there's some very liberal people within the military who... you know, go against that consensus, but, you know, the power is not on their side.
Well, what's the source of the political establishment's strength? Is it just inertia? Well, how do they keep this hold on power and policy?
I think largely through inertia, and I think largely through an increasingly apathetic Israeli public, which feels that it has no influence over political decision-making in the country anymore due to one factor or another, an increasing part of which is political corruption within the country. You know, you have to bribe anybody to get anything done, whether it's an extension to your house or a new road put in your community through the municipal, you know, government. And it's looking a lot like, you know, it's looking more and more third world in that regard politically. And this is a recent thing of like the last 15 years or so. There have always been elements of that in the Israeli political system because of the degree to which the old socialist system in the country really encouraged political patronage in a really sort of almost Stalinist sense. You know, and since the late 1980s, as the country has moved out of a state-dominated economic paradigm into a more traditional free market context, you know, this kind of corruption has just taken on more traditional non-socialist forms. Israelis find themselves increasingly embittered by this, and they don't know what to do, and they have looked many times for new political formations within the Israeli political system that would arise and basically put the house in order. And believe it or not, the current Kadima party was one of the things that runs the country, is one of the things that Ariel Sharon, of all people, promoted as being a solution to many of the country's historic problems. You know, and again, you know, Kadima, of course, proved to be absolutely useless. It has no ideology other than maintaining the authority of a traditional leadership clique within the country that had existed both in the Labor and the Likud parties. And Labor, which underwent what everybody thought was a dramatic transformation, since Amir Peres and his crew of people were elected to leadership positions in November 2005, turned out to be the greatest failure of all. They promised to be able to introduce a real social democratic party to the Israeli political system, and instead they simply recreated the old Labor Party with all of its historic political problems. So,
and then Peretz ended up as defense minister, didn't he?
And Lord knows why he took that position. People are still scratching their heads. He was actually a fairly effective, you know, trade unionist and labor rights advocate. And There are many people who argue that by having moved into the defense ministry and made the mistakes that he did starting in May 2006, that he set the Israeli left back over 15 years.
And they didn't have much room to be set back either, did they?
No. It went all the way back to the Dark Ages. In terms of political horizons, there's really not much to hope for. And so people like Netanyahu, who plunged the country into its, you know, worst economic situation since the mid-1950s with his privatization programs and his when he was finance minister under Sharon, further withdrawals he made of the state from the public sector. He put more Israelis into poverty than anyone can remember since the 1950s, and he also presided over an economic reconstruction of military budgets, which largely contributed to, you know, the relative level of military ineffectiveness that you saw take place in the Israeli campaign in Lebanon last summer.
Now, one theory of that that military failure I've heard is that a new generation of slacker youth have entered the Israeli army and they just don't have the energy and the zeal that they used to. Is there anything to that?
No. I think, look, you know, the Israel, you know, one must remember that the IDF is not a volunteer army. And so to the extent that the IDF still draws broadly on most sectors of Israeli society, it includes a lot of people who just don't want to be there, you know, a lot of Israelis don't want to be there, you know, from all, whether they're, you know, upper middle class hippies from North Tel Aviv or you know, working class kids from Sderot, where Peretz is from, you know, in the Negev. The army blew it because the army's burned out from waging a 5-year-long counterinsurgency campaign against the Palestinians, you know, and a lot of more conservative military minds argue that they've had their budgets completely slashed for things like training, so that, you know, tank crews were being sent out into the field to fight advanced anti-tank teams, or anti-tank Hezbollah anti-tank teams using advanced Russian weaponry, and they hadn't driven their tanks for 5 years. They'd been out on the street, you know, shooting Palestinian teenagers with tear gas canisters instead. So, you know, the Israeli military is having and has been having some kind of crisis of which its leadership and the political echelon are largely responsible for. I mean, I talked to some relatives who are in the army after the summer campaign, and a lot of them said that they felt that the military leadership had bought into too much of this American military rhetoric about downsizing your armed forces and having faster, more technologically agile, Donald Rumsfeld kind of formations out there dealing with guerrillas. And clearly, the Israelis, if that is true, and the Israelis really did buy into the whole American notion of a high-tech, agile military, then the Israelis bit it strategically in the same way the Americans have been biting it in Iraq for the last 4 years or 5 years. These are the kinds of explanations being offered. I just think that at a certain point, the Israeli public, which includes the military, is going to grow tired of continually being forced into full-scale combat situations, whether they be in the territories or in Lebanon or in Syria, and the military is not going to be able to produce the kind of victories that the country is historically used to Israel achieving.
I'm speaking with Joel Shalit, former managing editor of Tikkun magazine, author of the memoir Jerusalem Calling, and again, I apologize for the noisy background, but he's speaking to us from an airport waiting room, so that's the only way we could get him on here. You said once in this program that Israel needs war, otherwise it would have to face its own internal schisms. Do you still feel that?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think that quote from my book is, you know, still bears relevance in the sense that, war creates a constant diversion that allows, you know, whoever constitutes, the political and economic leadership of the country to continue to experiment, you know, in the background with the kind of state they want to create. And you know, the Israeli establishment has experimented with a number of different kinds of versions of the country over the years, if you will. You know, one of which was socialist, and another one right now, which is neoliberal. And the great thing about the 40 years of occupation that we've lived through these, you know, since my birthday in 1967, was that, you know, the 40th anniversary of the occupation is coming up in early June, has been that it has given a certain kind, a certain community of Israelis and a certain kind of Israeli political and economic inclination the free rein to transform the country's economy and politics in ways that were more analogous with the West, as it were, and the worst kind of West, you know, the West of Thatcher and the West of Reagan and Clinton and Blair. And it's unfortunate. Some argue that socialism was only a good thing for Israel as a founding ideology, you know, around which a state-controlled economy could legitimately emerge from in a post-colonial context of constant war and violent attrition with other, you know, surrounding nation states. That might be the case, but whatever kind of Israel these people are producing, it's turning into the kind of irresponsible tragedy that was manifest in the Vinograd report presented to Olmert about his failings during the Lebanon War last summer. And that's unacceptable. If you have some kind of stake in the continued existence of Israel in one form or another, whether it be, you know, in conjunction with the Palestinians or a separate state.
Let's turn a bit to the domestic front here. I've gotten the impression that at least in some sense, parts of the Zionist lobby in the United States are getting a little desperate. The war against Tony Judt at NYU was very intense, and to me, the intensity and desperation of it showed someone not quite as confident of his hold on power as perhaps they were familiar with. Am I just engaging a little wishful thinking here?
No. But what do you mean by wishful thinking in that?
Well, wishful thinking in that the intense Zionist lobby is losing some of its power to command.
I think the broad cultural consensus, or the broad consensus within the Jewish community about Israel since the establishment of the state in 1948, and most particularly since the 1967 war, has been that we are not to criticize Israel in public. We are not to discuss Israel's problems in public, particularly in the West, amongst the Goyim, because, you know, it will somehow work towards undermining Israel's international legitimacy, and it will help increase anti-Semitic, it will help encourage anti-Semitic actions towards us as representatives of Israel living abroad, as Jews. And that mentality has gone through a profound crisis, and Judt is right to point that out, as he has been doing. And the consensus is moving more in, you know, I wouldn't say the consensus is becoming as nuanced in a left-wing manner as that of Judt, but I would say that American Jews are far more comfortable to openly criticize Israeli foreign policy and Israeli conduct in the occupied territories. And that's a good thing. And I think that the vitriol you're seeing coming from conservative Jewish quarters in the United States, directed against people like Tony Judt, directed against liberal or progressive Jews, such as the attacks leveled at folks like Jacqueline Rose, and Judt by Alvin Rosenfeld, are simply symptomatic of that. You know, there was that horrible review by Kyle Smith in the New York Post a couple of weeks ago of Michael Chabon's new novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, where he, you know, called it an anti-Semitic tract because it chose to fictionally hypothesize the possibility that Israel was created in Alaska as a compromise instead of in Palestine in 1948, and that its its 60-year period of autonomy is coming to an end. Well, you know, if people like Chabon are really thinking that way in the United States, and sort of like Philip K. Dick putting Israel's fate as a novelist in those kinds of symbolic terms, the quote-unquote Zionist consensus has much bigger problems on its hands than simply somebody like Tony Judd, who is a left-wing intellectual, taking Israel to task for its treatment of the Palestinians. It means that American Jews are thinking about possible alternatives to what Jewish political sovereignty might mean outside of the specific Israeli situation. And that in itself is, you know, this could be the subject of its own book.
And then finally, do you think that the close association of Israel with the war in Iraq in a lot of Americans' minds is doing any damage to Israel's image here?
Iraq was what people can, you know, the people on the Jewish right and on the Israeli right can claim that it's the seditious activities of people like Judd that have caused the consensus to collapse. And they are wrong. The main thing is Iraq. You know, American Jews have been polled as having the second highest level of criticism of the Iraq war of any community in this country after the African-American community. And it is absolutely impossible for one to assume that that will not affect how they view the Israeli situation with the Palestinians.
All right, well, George Bush has done lots of damage in areas that he couldn't have even imagined when he started this war. Thank you for joining us, Joel Shalit. Joel is the former managing editor of Tikkun magazine and author of the memoir Jerusalem Calling, published by Akashic Books. Let's take a little break for station ID.
Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WVAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York. Enjoy.
And we're back. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. And let's take a little musical break before we hear from Fiona Harvey. And that a little piece of piano music by Arnold Schoenberg, and I apologize again that I had forgot my cue sheet that tells me what musical selections were playing. So all I can tell you is that was written by Arnold Schoenberg and performed by Glenn Gould. And now a segment about carbon offsets, carbon trading. I apologize again. I'm apologizing too much, so let me withdraw that. But I will acknowledge that I am fairly obsessed with the topic of climate change of late. Apologies if you're getting tired of it. More diversity of content will come after the fundraiser in a few weeks, I promise. But just one more segment here. One method of dealing with greenhouse gas emissions for people who can't or won't reduce theirs any further than they have is to buy what are called offsets. Offsets now are very fashionable. They were featured at the World Economic Forum in Davos this past January, where about two-thirds of the attendees purchased enough credits to offset the greenhouse gases that were emitted in their getting there and staying there. And same thing at the Academy Awards, which was also, I think, in January. Brad Pitt is a big fan of offsets. the band Coldplay kind of embarrassed itself when it prominently planted a bunch of mango trees that only ended up dying, so they didn't really do too much. Anyway, this is a big celebrity obsession now, is offsetting their lifestyle, because they still want to live in big houses and drive SUVs, I guess. But also whole companies have embraced the tactic. HSBC, the bank, is one of them. Several others have as well. But is this all worthwhile? Can you, by shelling out some cash to plant trees in Uganda or to buy low-energy light bulbs for the poor residents of the townships outside Johannesburg, can you really neutralize your emissions? Now, let's hear a couple of views on this. One, a balanced mainstream view from Fiona Harvey, who is the environment editor of the Financial Times. She was part of an investigation by that paper that found some pretty questionable products behind some high-sounding rhetoric. If you want to read some of that stuff, you can get it on the web at ft.com/carbon, ft.com/carbon. But Harvey argues that there's something real in offsets, too. For a more uncompromising view, I turn to Kevin Smith, author of a report from Carbon Trade Watch called The Carbon Neutral Myth, Offset Indulgences for Your Climate Sins, which you can get from their website, carbontradewatch.org. Okay, so first listen to Fiona Harvey, interview recorded earlier today.
Welcome, Fiona Harvey. First of all, let's start with the item in today's paper. The carbon market has tripled to $30 billion. What is this market? Who participates in it?
Well, this is a market that was set up by the Kyoto Protocol on climate change. And the idea of it is that instead of cutting your own emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, you can also pay for emissions cuts in other parts of the world. So, for instance, a rich country could fund carbon emissions reduction projects, such as wind farms, in a poor country, such as a country in Latin America or Africa or in Asia. So that sets up a trade in carbon emissions, because these projects are granted carbon credits, and the credits they get are based on the amount of carbon they've reduced. And these credits then have a value in the market because people can buy and sell them.
I noticed that China was a seller. China is about to surpass the U.S. as a greenhouse gas emitter. What credits mm-hmm. does China have to sell?
There are lots of projects in China to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. For instance, there are projects to reduce the emissions of industrial gases, such as there's a gas called HFC-23. It's hydrofluorocarbon, and it's a gas. It's a sort of byproduct of making refrigerants. And that gas can be reduced quite easily by putting a piece of equipment on the chimney of the factory that makes the refrigerants. And China has got quite a few of these factories and has generated quite a few carbon credits by putting this emissions reduction equipment into these factories.
Well, what guarantee is there that the credits sold actually represent something real on the other end?
Well, under the United Nations system, there's a pretty good guarantee, because all of those credits are actually verified by the UN and by independent third parties. And there's an awful lot of monitoring that goes on of these projects when they're certified by the UN. So if you're buying a credit through the UN, you can be pretty sure that that's a real credit, and it does exist. The problem is that there are other parts of the market which are not regulated by the UN, and in those parts of the market, it's much more difficult to be sure that you're getting what you pay for.
Well, you've been investigating that sort of thing. What sorts of chicanery have you found behind the credits?
Well, we find all sorts of things. We find companies who don't really appear to know what they're doing, even though they're trying to sell credits. We find companies who are selling credits that are basically environmentally worthless. They don't actually result in any reduction in emissions at all. We find companies selling credits at enormous prices relative to the prices they bought them for. And we find a lot of confusion in the marketplace that, you know, that there aren't really any clear-cut ways for people who want to buy credits to be sure of what they're buying.
A lot of consumers can go to a website and offset their lives. A lot of the people who went to Davos this year offset their visit to Davos. What about these sort of consumer for-profit enterprises? Do we know what is behind those?
They vary enormously. You know, some of them are great companies with, you know, really good business plans who are having their work checked by independent third parties and audited very carefully. So, you know, with those companies, you can be pretty sure that you're getting what you pay for. But on the other side of the market, you've got companies who, as I said, you know, have just been set up by people who think, well, you know, this offsetting is an interesting idea, I'll get into that. And, you know, essentially all you need to set up an offsetting company is a website and a mobile phone. So, you know, lots of people are doing it.
How can, if people actually want to do something, how can they determine whether they're actually dealing with somebody reputable and their action might make a difference?
They should do a little bit of research into any company that they're going to give money to. You should also look for the standards that exist in the voluntary market. There are two standards. There's one called the Voluntary Carbon Standard and there's another called the Gold Standard. And if the emissions reductions that you're buying conform to one of these standards, then you know you can have some reassurance that it's that these emissions reductions are genuine.
There is some concern that say if you take a plane flight, you spew greenhouse gases into the atmosphere over the course of several hours, but the offset may take up to 100 years to kick in. Do we really know that what the offset is actually accomplishing its mission, even if it is sold in good faith?
Well, it depends on the kind of offset you're buying. If you buy an offset that's based on forestry, on preserving trees that already exist or growing new trees, then yeah, that's going to take it's going to take as long as those trees take to grow, in order to you know reduce the carbon by the amount that that you want. But on the other hand, if you invest in say a wind farm that you know is going to be set up pretty quickly, or a project to say capture methane from a wastewater treatment plant, for instance, then you can be pretty sure that those emissions reductions are going to come online very quickly. So so you're not going to have to sort of sit around and wait for, you know, 50, 70 or 100 years for the carbon actually to be reduced.
A number of companies, well, HSBC to your colleague Martin Lukes's AB Global, have made a big splash out of going carbon neutral. What has their experience been when they actually get down to the details?
Well, I think the experiences have varied, but usually it's been pretty positive because the first thing that companies have to do if they want to become carbon neutral is to actually reduce their own emissions. And that means stopping wasting energy. That's the most important thing that they can do. That means looking at all of their processes to see, you know, where they can make savings, you know, savings in energy, obviously, but also savings in, you know, the use of materials, savings in water, because that can actually help to reduce your carbon emissions as well. Savings that actually make your business more efficient at the same time as reducing your greenhouse gas emissions. So companies actually can benefit a lot from this, just from that process. It can actually help them to save money. And then the business of offsetting comes at the end of that, because once you've reduced your emissions as much as you can, then you have to offset the rest by buying carbon credits. And really what companies need to do is to look very carefully at the companies they're buying offsets from. In just the same way that, you know, if you were negotiating a large contract on behalf of your company, you know, you'd look very carefully at the other parties that you were giving the money to. So that's how you should treat offsetting.
There's an enormous variation in the pricing of these offsets. Some seem very cheap, some seem considerably more expensive. How reasonable is the price for, say, a ton of carbon?
Well, it does vary wildly, and what you have to think about is the kind of project you want to invest in. I mentioned earlier, projects to reduce industrial gases from factories in China. Those projects are actually very cheap, but they generate a lot of carbon credits. So you can pick up carbon credits for that kind of project at quite a low price. But if you want to, say, set up a wind farm in somewhere that's quite inaccessible, and you want it to have other benefits, like bringing energy to local people. You want to have local people being involved and learning new skills, etc. Then that might be more expensive. So you might be expecting to pay something like $20 a ton for that, whereas for a cheaper kind of offset, you might only be paying $5 a ton.
So in other words, you really have to look at what's behind the money you're spending and not just think that expending a little bit of cash is going to set you right.
Exactly. I mean, this isn't really a problem that companies can just buy their way out of. You've really got to look into it. And companies, depending on the kind of project you want, you can usually find projects at the kind of price that you're prepared to pay, probably. I'd say, you should expect to pay $5 or above. You don't really want to try and get into paying anything lower than that because, you may start to run into problems. If you're prepared to pay that, then you can start to see some good offsets. And if you're prepared to pay a little bit more, then you get all these other benefits as well.
I'm speaking with Fiona Harvey, environment editor of the Financial Times.
Now, critics of carbon offsets have made a couple of points. I would like to hear your response to them. First, there's a kind of almost religious metaphor circulating that they're like the sale of indulgences in the Middle Ages, that people could buy the credits and then continue to go on polluting, or just like buying indulgences so you can keep to go on sinning. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think if companies are using them like that, then that's silly, because the point about going carbon neutral is that you ought to reduce your own emissions first. That's a really, really important thing to do. And if companies don't do that, then they're not really acting within the spirit of offsetting. So if I were looking at a company that was going carbon neutral, I would want to see clear evidence that they had reduced their own greenhouse gas emissions before they started buying in offsets.
And then another critique is that it's essentially an attempt by the rich world to dump their problem on the poor countries. That the poor countries will sell their credits because they're so strapped for cash, but that's actually foregoing development possibilities. So it allows the rich to remain rich and the poor to stay poor.
I don't really think that the poor countries could actually be foregoing development opportunities through this. Essentially, this is a win-win situation for poor countries, because it means that rich countries are paying them to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the poor countries, which is a good thing, but also paying to have technology installed, to have people trained in new skills that otherwise they wouldn't have access to. So, really, this can work very much to the benefit of poor countries.
Let's turn for a moment from the micro level to the broader level. What is happening with negotiations for a successor to the Kyoto Protocol?
That's an interesting question, because this year is going to be a very important year for discussions on what will follow the current provisions of the Kyoto Protocol, because the current targets expire in 2012, and unless we get some kind of agreement on something to follow the Kyoto Protocol beyond 2012, unless we get agreement on that within the next few years, then obviously it then becomes too late. I think an awful lot of work is being done behind the scenes from all the governments involved, and people are meeting in sort of different forums, within the UN Kyoto Protocol negotiations, and those will peak in December at a meeting in Bali, where the future of the protocol will be a hot topic. But governments are also meeting in other groups. They're meeting in the G8, and developing countries are meeting in the sort of G77. Countries are also meeting sort of informally. And of course, countries are meeting this week to discuss the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, which involves, you know, basically governments from all around the world. So, you know, there are a lot of discussions taking place this year on what will follow Kyoto. And really, you know, if the world is going to take this problem seriously, then there does need to be some kind of international framework. You know, whatever form that takes is up for discussion. But without some kind of sensible international framework, it's difficult to see how you can actually make progress on reducing emissions.
Are participants waiting for a new occupant in the Oval Office to make a difference in the progress of these talks?
A lot of people are saying that that would make a difference, but I think it would be wrong for people to pin too much on that. I think that there has been, there have been signs of some small changes in the position of the U.S. government to date, and that, you know, there are moves afoot within the U.S. now to bring in legislation that would mimic the Kyoto Protocol by putting in place a trading system for carbon. So, you know, there are interesting things going on. I mean, I don't think that the world necessarily has time to wait until there's a new occupant in the Oval Office to start actually tackling this problem.
But there is this problem. It's almost something out of a game theory text of the United States wants China and India to do something, and China and India say, well, you know, we're just new to this game of rapid growth, and you're the guys who caused most of the problems, so you go first. Is there any way to get around that kind of you go first problem?
Yeah, I mean, that's the classic problem, really, isn't it? I suppose the way to get around it is for some companies to take a lead, or some countries, excuse me, for some countries to take a lead and to say that, you know, that they're going to go ahead and reduce their emissions. And the European Union has tried to do that, because the European Union has said it will cut its emissions by 20% by 2020. And if other countries agree, then it will cut them by 30%. But even if there's no agreement, you know, that 20% target's still there. So the EU is trying to kind of break the logjam in that way. The other way to break the logjam, of course, is to get, you know, some kind of consensus, to get an agreement that gives every country certain, you know, targets and responsibilities and incentives.
And that was the voice of Fiona Harvey, who is the environment editor of the Financial Times, an interview recorded this morning. And another interview recorded also this morning with Kevin Smith, who is the author of a report called The Carbon Neutral Myth, Offset Indulgences for Your Climate Sins, published by Carbon Trade Watch, which you can download from Carbon Trade Watch, all one word, carbontradewatch.org. Okay, Kevin Smith.
Planting trees is a good thing. There can't be anything wrong with planting trees. It can only help, right?
It depends on the context of what in how trees are planted. I mean, you've got all sorts of episodes of monoculture plantations being imposed for a variety of reasons on southern countries, and these have had huge impacts on biodiversity. It's had huge impacts on food sovereignty and food security in these countries. There's also been a number of cases of people being evicted from their lands for tree plantations and so on. These are all quite extreme cases, but at the other end of the spectrum, in terms of climate change, there was a study that's put out by some scientists that was in Nature magazine recently that's saying it's very difficult to say whether planting trees outside of the tropics even has any kind of direct benefit in terms of mitigating climate change, because of the nature of the sunlight being reflected back off tree cover and the heating levels of that causes. So it's just not so simple. It's a very nice idea that planting trees is a good thing for climate change, but it's the genuine picture is a lot more complicated than that. And there's also the quote from the Cambridge academic who says that planting trees to deal with climate change is like telling people to drink glasses of water to cope with rising sea levels. It's just not in any way a kind of permanent or reliable means of dealing with climate change.
Now, are other projects, for example, building wind farms or windmill farms or providing energy-efficient light bulbs in South Africa, what's your evaluation of these sorts of projects?
On the one hand, with all offset projects, you've got kind of underlying methodological issues which revolve around calculating how much of a climate benefit a project brings about. And now, in order to do that, you have to do something. We have to calculate the baseline, and the baseline is what would have happened in a situation if the project hadn't taken place. And once you've got that baseline, then you use that to kind of calculate the amount of emissions credits that the kind of project generates. Now, there's just so much speculation involved in saying what would have happened if the project hadn't taken place. There's an enormous number of variables that could have influenced what could have happened. And you end up with such a kind of abstract, hypothetical idea that it's actually very shaky. There's no kind of agreed consensus on how to kind of generate these baselines. It's just not possible to kind of calculate to any meaningful degree how much of a kind of climate benefit is generated by a kind of offset project, because it's so speculative trying to work out what would have happened if the project hadn't taken place. And so there's no kind of possibility of establishing a genuine equivalence between the amount of emissions you're responsible for when you take a flight, for instance, and the amount of emissions that might have been saved through the intervention of a certain offset project. And so as a commodity to be sold on the market, offset credits don't have any kind of real credibility because you can't accurately quantify how much of them there actually are.
So is the whole concept irredeemably bogus in your view?
I think so. Apart from the innate methodological issues, I think you've also got the kind of fact that all these offset schemes are putting the focus on individual lifestyles, on individual carbon footprints and consumer choices. Now, as much as I kind of advocate people taking action in their individual lifestyles and switching to low energy bulbs and stopping flying where possible and using cars a lot less and so forth, the very kind of limited part of the picture with climate change. And we have to be kind of asking some kind of deeper questions about the societies we live in, the way we're structuring our economies, north-south relations and so on. And these are all, it's very important that we kind of look at the bigger picture and start making some kind of serious systemic changes to our societies in order to make the kind of transition to a low-carbon economy that's really necessary. With all the kind of emphasis and spotlight on kind of lifestyles, it's kind of detracting attention away from this bigger picture. And this, I think, is one of the kind of most really kind of fundamental reasons why the existence of these carbon offsets is actually quite corrosive to the climate change discourse.
In your report, you use the phrase carbon colonialism. What do you mean by that?
Carbon colonialism refers to the fact that basically the most kind of carbon-intensive lifestyles of anywhere in the world are lived by people in Europe and North America. And so at the end of the day, we need to be kind of addressing that fact by making these kind of real reductions in our lifestyles here. We can't just be exporting the problem to countries in the global south for the reason that we're just kind of using the global south as yet another resource to exploit in the kind of ongoing history of neocolonialism. What we're kind of exploiting now is the cheap potential of these countries to make emissions reductions. And I think it's quite kind of morally reprehensible when you've got a person in India who has a kind of average carbon emissions who's eight times less that of a person in the UK, but you're still expecting that person to make even more reductions on your behalf. I think it's kind of premised on very kind of dubious north-south relationships of economic power.
And that was the voice of Kevin Smith, who is the author of a report published by Carbon Trade Watch, which you can get from carbontradewatch.org, the report called The Carbon Neutral Myth, Offset Indulgences for Your Climate Sins. Carbon Trade Watch is a project of the Transnational Institute. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and I will be back next week, I think, for the fundraising special. Till then, let's so long, and let's go out with this. And again, I apologize for not having remembered my cue sheet with the names of the songs, but this is the new single from The Enemy.
I'm so sick, sick, sick and tired of working just to be retired. I don't want to get that far. I don't want your company car. Promotions ain't my thing. Name badges are not interesting. It's much easier for me, see, to stay at home with Richard and Judy. Well, it's not exactly